This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. How are North Carolina's jails responding to the COVID-19 pandemic? Prisons have faced a lot of public and political pressure to protect their populations by letting some people out, but jails haven't gotten the same attention. And information about what's happening in these facilities is hard to come by. Felicia Arriaga is looking into how sheriffs and jails are changing policies in light of the pandemic, and she's collecting data on outbreaks. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Appalachian State University and joins me now. Welcome back, Felicia.
Hi, it's great to be here again.
It's good to have you. But what do we know so far about outbreaks in jails across North Carolina?
Sure. I think we just don't know much. Fortunately, I think there was a shift, at least at the state level, where the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services started to put this up on their congregate facility information that they put out every Tuesday and Friday. So that's one way for us to get a little bit of the sense of what's going on. But otherwise, back in April or May, myself and my research team, we started to at least send out some requests for information from the jails across the state. Also because we already knew that a lot of just information about jails in general is not publicly available, or at least it's not tracked in some kind of systemic way. And we often see that this is the case, especially when it comes to things like jail deaths. So I think we were concerned about what was going on and wanted to at least try to get a little bit of information about the practices and procedures that were taking place, and then try to really think about, is there some additional sort of steps that jails could be taken, as well as listening to community members in those areas, as far as what they were hearing. A lot of those groups who have been doing law enforcement accountability work for a long time were really, I think, instrumental in leading us into, these might be some questions that we should be asking of law enforcement agencies throughout the state.
So you put out the ask, trying to find some of the information that is not available publicly. What kind of response did you get?
Sure. So as to be expected with any of this information, obviously, like, any person can do a public records request or request for some of this information. But I've done this in the past for some different policies when it comes to law enforcement agencies. And so we got about a response of almost 60 or so jails from across the state or sheriffs responding to us with some of their information, which was good. Sometimes it could be lower than that. So we're excited, and we're about to go into round two of some of these requests. And so we're asking really questions about population dynamics, some of the health and safety protocols, and then if they were also working with other agencies at the local level to decarcerate and or to try to decrease jail populations as a response. And so that was one of the ones findings that's a little bit more interesting, just seeing how in some places how proactive some of the sheriffs were to work with the district attorney's office to really consider how they would lower the population within the jails to stop the spread of COVID. And so I think that there's sort of a variety of responses that occurred in some of the smaller jails. There wasn't necessarily such an emphasis on trying to limit the amount of people going into jails, but that's because I think according to those offices, they at least had enough capacity to think about proper procedures and social distancing within the jail in those places. So it varies, I think, on the size of the jail, as well as some of the initiatives from the sheriffs on the ways that they then decided to go about trying to decrease the spread or try to at least prevent the spread of COVID within their jails.
All right. And we're going to take a look at some of those details, a little bit about what we found and maybe some of the challenges to providing some of those things. But first, let's set a little more of the context. First of all, you heard from almost 60 of 98 jails in the state. And and so let's talk about what makes people incarcerated in jails particularly vulnerable to COVID-19.
Sure. There's not, if you ever sort of been in a jail or done a jail tour, there's not necessarily the most space in certain jails to be able to socially distance. And there's at least the concerns, some of the concerns that we were seeing, at least in the responses too, is that we didn't necessarily want to see that individuals are being incarcerated for longer parts of time within sort of like their pods within the jail. So there's also sort of an emphasis on how much time are they spending in, say, common areas, which we would expect that would be a way for people to contract the virus if they're in common areas. But then the alternative to that is keeping people within their cells. And so there's sort of a back and forth on how much time do people even have to be out and about when they're incarcerated is one really the bigger concern when it comes to even the possibility of social distancing. Often, even here in North Carolina, but across the country, we see that there isn't enough room for people to really social distance in the way that's recommended by, say, the CDC or, say, any of the sort of public health agencies.
I know one of the things that you found is that there's not a lot of standardization across the state, so jails and counties are pretty free to do and manage this any way they want. But what kind of policies have you seen? Obviously a great deal of variety, but give us an example of some of the different policies that are in place at various jails across the state.
Sure. The majority of ones that we got information from, they are at least taking temperature checks of both employees and individuals who are arrested and then incarcerated in the jail when they first enter. The majority of places were quarantining or at least like separating those people who have recently entered for a certain amount of time before they're then put into the general population. So there are some initial measures when people are coming in. I think beyond that, unfortunately, we do see the variety of responses where there's letters coming out from individuals who are incarcerated to their family members suggesting that they're not being provided with masks. And some additional sort of ways to then like sanitize whenever they're actually in the jail. And so those are some of the bigger sort of variations that we saw for a while across the state. And this was from coming from the state level, that there was also no longer in-person visitations, which was also sort of thought to stop some of the increase in the spread of COVID, as well as stops of transfers between the jail and prison system. Since June, I believe, that the transfers, at least between the jails and prisons, has continued once again. And so as far as thinking about the spread in between those two sort of bigger pieces of adult corrections, that's also, I think, a concern for people. So there's been some sort of state-level things that have dictated how things are happening within the local jails. But then again, there's variation by sort of the sheriff and the jail and administration as well.
I'm talking to Felicia Arriaga, who's an assistant professor of sociology at Appalachian State University. I want to bring another guest into the program who's working on decreasing jail populations. Andrea Muffin Hudson is executive director of the North Carolina Community Bail Fund of Durham. Muffin, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
What are you hearing from people who are incarcerated at the Durham County Detention Center?
What has happened since there was an outbreak a couple of weeks ago, their calls have gotten less frequent. But prior to that, they were saying that they didn't have the proper PPE to, you know, keep themselves safe. They were only given one mask, and that was it. And some folks weren't given a mask at all because they didn't have enough, and they weren't being tested. And now when they do call, they're on lockback. So they only come out like 30 minutes every 3 days. And so they have to decide whether they're going to make a phone call or whether they're going to take a shower.
Mm. So that's a lockback. And you described that. Maybe you can describe what that is in greater detail and the fact that that's now becoming a kind of a policy, right?
Right. A lockback is where they're locked in their cell and they're not allowed to come out into the common areas. They're not allowed to, you know, use the phone, take showers, or eat at the tables. They have to eat in their cell.
Mm. And so, and now that that's becoming, I mean, it had been punishment. Obviously, it's being done for protection, but this is sort of the way, it seems, that at least in Durham County, that they're trying to manage the situation. Is that what you're hearing?
That's their way of managing it, but it's clearly not managing the situation because people are still testing positive with COVID, because initially they said they had 4, then they said they had 8, then they had 12, now they have 100. So whatever they're doing is not working.
Yeah, and that had been considered more or less a punishment before. So this is a step that they've taken, and as you say, it has questionable effectiveness. Felicia, across the state, is lockback happening in other institutions, do you know?
So we don't know. So this is not something that was indicated, at least in the initial request we sent. This is one of the things that we'll be trying to get a little bit more clarity on in the second round of requests. So Durham was the first place that I had heard of it, also from family members of individuals who are incarcerated there. So I expect it's probably something that is happening, especially in these bigger jails where we have seen sort of these recent outbreaks. I think Alamance County now is also 100-plus cases. Mecklenburg County is closer to 60 in the last report that came out from the Department of Health and Human Services on Friday. So I'm sure that they're thinking of sort of new ways to try to stop this. I think this morning, to speak to Durham as well, this morning Sheriff Burkhead gave a presentation, a briefing to the county commissioners for a sort of plan to mass test. And so I think Muffin and I have talked previously that in some places, I think we've expected that perhaps they would have done better sort of preventative measures. But this is the situation we're in now.
Well, let's talk more about that situation we're in now, because the lockback, for instance, as we say, doesn't seem to have checked the spread very much. It's hard to know how it would have been otherwise, but the disease, the illness does continue to spread despite the lockbacks. Talk about the mental health effects of this for people who are inside, Muffin.
It's very, very disheartening to have people call and they want to be free. I want them to be free. But because the bail fund has a limit on how much we can pay to bail folks out, I can't pay some of these bonds, which are, you know, $50,000, $100,000. And these are for alleged crimes that people have committed. They haven't been convicted of a crime. So the crime in itself is that they're being held on pretrial detention, and they're basically given a death sentence because there's always a possibility they can catch COVID, and we know that they're not going to receive the proper medical treatment that they would need in order to survive. So that's the crime, that we're holding people on pretrial.
Well, and the prison decel, when we're talking, Felicia, about prisons, of course, decarceration had gotten a lot of attention, releasing people who may not be considered a threat to the population at large after testing and recognizing that they weren't infected. That became something that got a lot of attention at the state level for prisons. Felicia, did you see a similar push to lower jail populations?
Yeah, so I think in about 40 of the places that we requested information from, so 40 of the jails and sheriffs, they did respond that they were trying to work with individuals in either in district attorney's office or the public defender's office to try to at least do a few things, which was think about bond modifications for arrestees, something that Muffin has been sort of advocating for a long time in her work, but then also a few additional things. So we also saw that especially at the beginning of the pandemic, that some of the arrests, or at least like the recommendation for any type of law enforcement that was doing arrests and patrolling, was to actually provide folks with citations instead of actually physically arresting them. So that has also, at least in initial stages, like decreased some of the amount of people coming into the jail in the first place. So we've seen a few different things happen. Unfortunately, I think on the other side of things, for folks who might have already been in jail, we're also seeing the increased use of electronic monitoring, and so in other types of supervised and unsupervised probation. So it's not necessarily that they're being released without sort of any of the quote-unquote punishments that we might think of, but they're actually being released to sort of some kind of alternative policing mechanism.
Muffin, talk about your work, because you are working to reform the bail system. That means you're working closely with people who are incarcerated and have been doing that kind of work. How has that changed during the COVID-19 pandemic?
I just want to give one little correction. I'm not trying to reform bail. I'm trying to abolish it because there's no need for it. Like, money shouldn't determine whether or not someone comes to court or not. But it's changed because now we can't offer people the type of support that we offered them previously. So now we do rolling protests every Friday at the jail to bring awareness to the fact that people are being held on pretrial detention. They haven't been convicted of a crime, but they're being held because they're poor, because they don't have the money to buy back their freedom. So that's why they're being held. So we do that. we aren't allowed to offer court support like we did previously when we bailed folks out. We would go to court with them so, you know, they wouldn't be in court alone. Now they have it where we are not allowed in the courthouse. Sometimes only one person can go in. And then when I do go in to courthouse, I can't get into the courtroom. And so the person still has to face the judge and the DA by themselves, pretty much, other than just having a public defender with them. So that has changed a lot because we're used to being able to court mob for folks and let the judge and the DA's office know that we care about the people in our community and we want them to stay within our community. We don't want them to be held hostage anymore, but we can't do that now.
And this has also changed the way visiting can happen at the jails. Is that right, Muffin?
Yes. So they have video visitation, but that's it. There's no in-person visitation. And they said that they did that to make sure that there wasn't a spread of COVID. But as long as you're arresting people, you still have the possibility of introducing COVID into the jail because you're still bringing people in who have been on the outside. So I don't see how visitation would curb that, considering that there's glass in between folks anyway. It's not like a direct contact with people, but that's the reason why they said they canceled visitation other than video.
I would imagine this is also having some effect on the mental health of the people you're talking with. Are you getting a sense from them that this is creating added difficulties?
It is. It's a lot of people that are in fear, and they're scared, you know, and they're constantly worrying and stressing themselves, worrying about whether or not they're going to catch COVID, whether or not they're going to be able to come home to their loved ones. And then even if they do get released, whether or not they don't know if they have COVID, because everyone that is currently housed in the Durham County Jail hasn't been tested for COVID. So they worry about whether or not, do I have it and don't know I have it? And then if I get out, am I going to give it to my loved ones when I go home? Because I just don't know. But they don't want to be there because they're worried. So that's added stress on folks. And folks have underlying conditions that they may not know that they have simply because they don't have medical coverage. So they don't know if they have underlying medical conditions that can enhance the possibility of them getting COVID.
In the short run, Muffin, what would you like to see change to help protect people who are in jails from this pandemic?
I would like for them to be released. I say free them all and give them citations of when their court date is and let them come to court.
There's been some data, too, and some research on the fact that in many cases, some of the research that's been done has shown that people, in fact, do come back. The fear, I guess, is that people wouldn't show up. But in fact, where these reforms have been, in this case a reform, is put in place and people were asked to come back, the majority did. So it's fascinating to think about that research anyway. Felicia, what kind of solutions are you proposing sort of statewide that you'd like to see to help protect people in jails?
Sure. So I think the sort of move to decarcerate is one that I think is both one that's been already pushed here prior to the pandemic and nationally as well. I think, as already Muffin mentioned, some of the issues with the medical services, I think that there's a push for some kind of prorated or free medical services, especially in this time, is something that is necessary. And then I think this universal testing, although that's something at least like this morning, again, when Sheriff Burke had presented to the Durham County Commissioners, was really the topic of discussion was how much this would actually cost. And I think that that's something that the cost in this moment should be secondary. I think that in one of the responses we got from one of the offices, I think that there was just one that emphasized that actually we're trying to protect folks or protect people's constitutional rights they already have. And so I think if more people were actually considering that component of incarceration too, that we would see a different response that would actually prioritize wellness and safety if people are not going to be immediately released, as Muffin already suggested.
Felicia Arriaga is an assistant professor of sociology at Appalachian State University. Felicia, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Andrea Muffin Hudson, executive director of the North Carolina Community Bail Fund of Durham. Muffin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org.